You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Imagine you've survived cancer. You live with the ever-present fear of a recurrence. Now imagine that you develop a second cancer, completely different than your first, and it's a strange one like melanoma that can rapidly spread throughout your body and drastically impact your health. My guest today survived a bout with breast cancer, and 3 years later was found to have melanoma, which at first seemed cured simply by removing it from her skin. Compound that by the fact that her first husband, back in Poland, died from metastatic melanoma, and you have the setup for an epic tale of illness and survival. In her new memoir, neuroscientist Barbara Lipska details her own bout of metastatic melanoma that impaired her judgment, vision, decision-making, and word-finding, just to name a few skills she lost. Fortunately, Lipska was enrolled in a clinical trial involving a form of immunotherapy that helped her multiple brain tumors regress to the point that her mental and functional illness cleared up entirely, allowing her to once again participate in sports and work as a researcher. Barbara Lipska serves as the director of the Human Brain Collection Corps at the National Institute of Mental Health in Bethesda, Maryland, and is the author of a new memoir, The Neuroscientist Who Lost Her Mind. She's my guest today on Studio Tulsa, Medical Monday. Barbara Lipska, welcome to Medical Monday. First, I just want to ask how you're doing now.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me, and I'm doing fine. I'm not exactly as I was before this ordeal, about which we'll be talking, but I'm okay. I'm alive.
Right. Well, I'm very glad to hear that. And of course, you have now written this memoir of your illness. And I just want to point out to our listeners that the book, The Neuroscientist Who Lost Her Mind, is really about your ordeal with melanoma that was metastatic and affected your brain. But I actually want to start earlier than that. You were also a survivor of breast cancer. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
That's right. It happened in 2009. Again, as with these things, all of a sudden. And it turned out to be quite advanced. I had to have a mastectomy, and that was it. I mean, that was not it. I had radiation also and chemo. So no sight of that ordeal until now.
One of the things that was so intriguing about your book, and we'll talk a little bit about your melanoma, was sort of the opening scene, the prologue, which comes back toward the middle. You are very frank about the fact that you had a unilateral mastectomy, and then you wear a prosthesis. And in this kind of shocking scene where you're in the throes of really affected by essentially a form of cancer in your brain, your judgment is pretty impaired. Now, you're a very athletic person, let's just say, and you are a skier, you have done many triathlons, but I guess, can you set the scene for us that opens your book, where you're sort of, let's just say, running for miles and miles with a little bit less, more disheveled than you might otherwise be?
Yes, so this was the first sign. No, it was not the first sign. It was the first sign that I was losing my mind, but not the first sign that I had tumors in my brain. So I decided to run that morning, as usually, in the neighborhood. So through the neighborhood that I know very well, and I know all the streets there. But I couldn't come back home. I didn't know where I was. Not only that, I was inappropriately dressed for this run. I was wearing very skimpy top, and as you mentioned, I didn't even put my prosthetic breast on, so I looked weird. But what's more, I decided to color my hair right before going for a run and put a plastic cap on top of my head. I usually don't do this. And I was running for about 2 hours. This dye dripped down my shirt, my chest, my neck, turned into black rivulets running down, dripping down my clothes. I must have looked very weird, but I didn't see it. I was unable to notice my state.
What tipped you off? I mean, was it when you got home and your husband sort of saw you and said, "What are you doing?" Or I think the way you write about it, he was a little more sympathetic and just sort of questioned you, and you said, I'm running, and I mean, you didn't really know what you were doing, and he sort of said, okay.
So first I caught a glimpse of myself in the mirror in the hallway, and I saw all this, but I didn't register really that it's something unusual. So I went upstairs where he worked, and he turned around, and he gasped. So what happened to you? You're looking, do you see how you're looking? And I said, what? What happened? Nothing happened. I'm okay. And he's a very patient and quiet man, so he didn't lash out. He was like, go and wash yourself. But you already noticed that I'm acting a little funny at times. It was not all the time, but funny is an understatement of what I was doing.
Well, do you have any recollection of these events, or was it sort of after you went through treatment, you were able to kind of piece together these memories or look at journals or things like that?
Yes, both. I mean, I remember some events a little bit when they were told to me by my family, mostly my husband. I remembered more. But strangely, I had absolutely no recollection of any emotional feelings that either I or others felt at the time. So I didn't notice, I don't remember that he was gasping and he was, shocked by the way I looked. I thought everybody else around me was acting abnormal, and I was the only one who was normal.
Yeah, I guess plays into sort of what is often associated with some forms of mental illness, the sort of paranoia, is you think everyone else is acting strange and you're the one acting normal, when I guess in fact an objective observer would say, no, you're the one acting very differently than you normally act. So you had some really impaired judgment. Tell us about the melanoma. I mean, how did that come about? And for our listeners, it's not related, we think, to your breast cancer at all. It's just sort of a bad luck that you also had this kind of skin cancer that metastasized.
That's true. There is no link, and I met with a geneticist to figure it out, and they said, no, it is probably just bad luck, as you said. So melanoma, I had melanoma on my skin in 2000, almost 2012. At the end of 2011 and 2012, and it was dissected out, it was cut out, and I had radiation to the large area on my neck. And we thought it was it, because it was a stage one melanoma, so considered in many cases curable. But 3 years later, so at the beginning of 2015, it was January, at the time, I was training for a triathlon, so I was leaving the pool, going to work after that, and I felt a little off. I drove, actually, to my office in Bethesda, Maryland. I sat at my desk. I put both of my hands on the keyboard, and I moved my right hand to the right, and it disappeared. It vanished. And I did it several times. I brought it back to the left. I could see it. I moved it to the right, it would disappear as if it were cut off at the wrist. It was freaking me out. It was something that I never, of course, experienced, and I never knew that it could happen.
And, you know, it would freak anybody out, I think. But you add in the fact that you're a neuroscientist with a very deep understanding of the neuroanatomy of the brain. And so, you know, it led you to certain, I won't say firm conclusions, but you had some guesses as to what might have been going on. And what did that indicate to you when you lost this vision of your hand, or this seeing your hand in a certain visual field?
So the first thought was, of course, brain tumor. But I quickly expelled it from my brain as too deadly, or I guess too terrifying, and I kept working. In other words, I was too busy to think about brain tumors. I had no time for tumors, almost. Scientists next door were waiting for me. We had a conference. And what's more, next day I was going to the Winter Brain Conference. This is a conference on brain research. And I was not only going to participate in the conference that I organized and I was chairing, but I was going to ski, which I love so much. So in other words, I couldn't be bothered with brain tumors. It sounds weird, but that's exactly what happened. I went into denial. It didn't last long. It lasted for several hours. But then it turned out that I had three tumors in my brain. One was bleeding, and it was in my visual cortex.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, it just sounds so frightening. I'm going to reintroduce you. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Barbara Lipska, who is the director of the Human Brain Collection Corps at the National Institute of Mental Health, and has just written the memoir called The Neuroscientist Who Lost Her Mind, which is her tale of madness and recovery. Tell us a little bit about what you do in your day job. I mean, you've been a neuroscientist for decades now, and you work at the National Institute of Mental Health, as you mentioned, in Bethesda, Maryland. What kinds of things do you do in your work?
Yeah, so all my life, I studied mental illness. First in my native Poland, and then at the NIMH, Mental Institute of National Institutes of Health. We collect brains to study mental illness. So we're particularly interested in schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, depression, but also some other mental disorders. So we collect these brains for investigations into mostly molecular function of the brain. So we try to understand how the normal brain functions and what is different in people with mental illness.
And you point out in the book that at least at this stage of diagnostics in our medical community, we can't really, there's no blood test or we can't do MRIs, straight MRIs, I guess, that help us with diagnosing conditions like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. But there are certain forms of what are called functional MRI where you can see different forms of uptake of tracers that, with glucose to show increased or decreased areas of brain activity. Anatomically, you're looking at the actual brains themselves, and as you point out, the microscopic slices of them. I mean, what, I guess, for a lay audience, the radio listeners, you know, what are some things you could share with us that are major differences in the brain of someone who has had schizophrenia versus what you might call a normal brain?
Yes, I wish I could tell you with confidence what it is, but we are still far away from knowing. So functional MRIs show some differences, but not in particular people. We cannot diagnose anybody based on MRI. We find group differences in function of the brain looked at by functional MRI or even by structural MRI scans. But the differences are very, very subtle, and the ranges of variability are very wide. So not in one person looking at these scans you can say, oh, that's the brain of mentally ill person. It is actually similar if we look at the molecular level. We can detect some differences, group differences, between expression of genes, but we cannot say that that person, if we could measure these molecules in a living brain, that this person has this or that mental disorder. We're still far away, unfortunately. We can also detect in very large groups of patients with either schizophrenia, bipolar, or less so in depression, differences in how genes are structured. So what kind of letters, in other words, they have in their genome. But again, these are group differences or differences that relate to a particular family of people, but not across the board. So there is no markers yet that could determine if the person is healthy in terms of mental health or has any particular mental disorder, unfortunately.
Tell us a little bit more about the Human Brain Collection Core. Is it something that is it a huge database at this point that you know you're building kind of brain by brain or slice by slice? And is it like publicly available for researchers to look at, or is even something that I'm picturing sort of a brain museum where the public could go in and look? Is there anything like that?
So it's not much to look at, but we have around we have over 1,000 brains. There are almost all of them are frozen. They on arrival they are sliced into thick slabs or slices, and immediately frozen at a very low temperature, so not to disturb the tissue very much. So these thick slices are then put in plastic bags. Plastic bags are put in the boxes, and the boxes are placed in the freezers. We have about 20 deep freezers in our brain bank. So these brains take a lot of space in our lab. So what do we do next? Any investigator who is investigating brain function or brain dysfunction in these various mental disorders can request pieces of brains. So the investigators are usually interested in particular brain regions. So if they are interested in frontal cortex, they will write to us that a request for a particular project. They have to describe this project, what they're looking for, what is their hypothesis, what methods they are going to apply, and how many subjects they need of what diagnosis. And then we consider this project, discuss it, and most likely, most often, we agree, maybe with modifications. Maybe we advise the investigators that they should change this or that, increase or decrease the group of people that they are asking for. And then we hope that by doing this, we are helping in research on mental illness.
I want to switch back to your story of treatment for melanoma. You underwent a brain surgery to try to remove the tumors, and then there was a sort of a discussion around conventional treatment versus something newer, which is called immunotherapy, and you were part of a clinical trial. And you write very dramatically and emotionally about how determined you were, bringing some of your athletic determination to bear in getting through this clinical trial. I mean, you were very determined to make it through. I guess share with us sort of what the initial treatment was and then how you got in the clinical trial and how important that was for you.
You're right. We started with neurosurgery because that bleeding tumor that blocked my vision initially had to be removed. It was pretty large, and the fact that it was bleeding was the worst because it was really this is what was blocking my vision. So it was taken off. The smaller ones couldn't be surgically removed because they were too small to see by the surgeon. I regained my vision immediately after surgery, so everything looked good. I didn't feel other tumors, obviously. But a few weeks later, three more tumors appeared in my brain. And it was obvious to all of us, my family, myself, and the doctors, that new tumors will be growing, that we have to come up with some other treatment. And the treatment at the time, and it's still the best option for melanoma, is immunotherapy. So infusion of monoclonal antibodies into patients' veins, and these antibodies block certain proteins on T cells, immune cells. And by doing this, T cells can again recognize, again, because they couldn't. That's why I got proliferating tumors in my brain. So they can again recognize melanoma, alien cells that are doing something that they shouldn't be doing.
So let's just clarify. So those T cells are your cells. We all have those that are immune cells that fight infection, or tumors, or as you said, other things that are not normally inside the body. And what these melanoma tumors are very tricky. They're able to, in a sense, mask themselves from our immune system, and that's how they proliferate. But these monoclonal antibodies, which are really just essentially revved up proteins that are administered through your bloodstream, are able to go onto the cell surface of the melanoma?
To activate my T cells again so that they see that melanoma cells are alien, that they are something that should not proliferate. So they would block them from proliferation.
And it sounds so simple, but it's not, even though they're targeting the melanoma cells and it sounds like a clean process, you can get very sick. And tell us what happened to you.
So I thought, and everybody thinks, that immunotherapy is much better than chemo in terms of side effects. But it still produces lots of side effects because it revs up the immune system. It may cause inflammation of organs that you don't want to inflame. So I got inflammation of skin, which is manifested by having rashes, sometimes horrible rashes. My thyroid was so revved up that I actually lost it. I don't have thyroid gland anymore, which is working. And it also revved up my pituitary to the point that I'm not producing cortisol. I have to take it in a form of pill. So it, and of course, it worked because I'm alive and I can talk about it. And I'm very glad that I underwent this therapy, but it's not as benign as we would like to think.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Barbara Lipska, who is a neuroscientist. She directs the Human Brain Collection Corps at the National Institute of Mental Health. And she's just written a memoir of her illness called The Neuroscientist Who Lost Her Mind, Her Tale of Madness and Recovery. And Barbara Lipska, I wanted to ask how important you think your athletic training was in your survival, because you have photographs in the book and talk a little bit about your triathletic career and how, you know, I was just so impressed. I mean, you were going through chemotherapy, you had surgery, I think at various points even radiation, and then of course this immunotherapy, and you certainly weren't doing triathlons during a lot of that, but you were still running or biking as you were able to. And then at one point I think you were sort of so depleted you were just walking through the park, and that in and of itself was another story.
Yeah, I love sports. So life for me is full life is to be able to engage in all these activities, running, swimming, biking, skiing, and just walking. Being outside makes me very happy. I thought at the time when I was diagnosed with metastatic melanoma in my brain, I thought I was preparing for races. I was about that year to enter a half Ironman competition. And I was thinking about if it goes well next year, I will be doing the full Ironman. I didn't realize that these races were preparing me both physically and mentally, not for races, that these sports prepared me not for races, but for the greatest challenge of my life, fighting for survival. Did it help? I'd like to believe that it did, but I have no proof of that. I think the stamina that I have that sport, any kind of endurance sport, trains people to do, helped a lot. It was a pretty dramatic ordeal that I went through. It required a lot of strength, both mental and physical.
And it also seems like you had very key in your recovery was family support. I mean, a very supportive husband and adult children who were incredibly supportive to you. And then, you know, even grandchildren to whom, you had a lot of a desire to stay alive in order to see them grow. I want to ask a question about, your literary career now. So I look back and I think it was in March of 2016, the first sort of very public story that you shared was in the, it was appeared in a Sunday New York Times, and it had the very same title, The Neuroscientist Who Lost Her Mind. And I guess from there, somebody was interested enough to say, hey, we'd love to have a book from you about this. And then not almost exactly 2 years later, this book is out and with more detail and really quite a compelling story of really of hope and recovery. How did this all come about?
So you first asked about family, and family always played a huge role in my life. I was always very involved in bringing up my grandsons and my children before. And then they were incredibly supportive during this whole terrifying 2 years that I went through, through all kinds of treatments. So nobody can go, I think it would be very hard to go over this being alone. I cannot imagine. My family was absolutely critical for this. So writing, how did it happen? When I started writing memoirs when I was handed a death sentence in the form of having melanoma in my brain, I was absolutely sure I'll die. And it prompted me to write down many things from my life that I never talked about. I mean, I did, but especially to my children, they didn't know the details of how they grew up in Poland, how I was a child. So I started writing a memoir about my early life experience, my experiences with my children, about how my husband died, because that's a huge part of my life, too. He died of metastatic melanoma. So I was writing all this, and then I went insane myself. And when I was coming out of it, it was a revelation for me when I regained my sanity that I could have gone, I could have been lost so much. I have to share this experience with others. It's too bizarre to be just left to me. So I started writing about experience with the metastatic melanoma, how I lost my mind and how I regained it, about the treatments, about the help from my family, friends, and people around me, and doctors, of course.
Well, it's a compelling story, and I'm so happy to be able to talk to you today for your courage in having survived really separate ordeals, you know, first with breast cancer and then with metastatic melanoma. Barbara Lipska is the author of The Neuroscientist Who Lost Her Mind, Her Tale of Madness and Recovery. And Barbara serves as, works at the National Institute of Mental Health, where she is the director of the Human Brain Collection Corps. Barbara Lipska, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.